eye down upon them. She had arranged for a trolley with a TV and PC to be wheeled into the interrogation room too. The interview had not gone very well. She had taken de Lacy back through the events of the previous day and then asked him a series of questions. He had refused to answer any of them, responding with a mixture of nonchalance and ease that she quickly found infuriating. She concentrated on maintaining her professionalism. "Milton was sitting where you were last week," she said. "He was there and I was here. And now look."
"Lawyer,"
de Lacy said. "You know you're going to be charged with attempted homicide, don't you?"
"Lawyer."
"Your friend shot my colleague, a police officer. He's in intensive care. They don't know whether he'll make it. 50-50, they said. If he doesn't, you're looking at murder."
"Lawyer."
"Are you sure, Mr. de Lacy?"
"I am."
"It won't matter," she said. "There are three witnesses to what you did. There's nothing a lawyer will be able to say that will make any difference."
"Milton's going to testify against me."
"Really?"
"I doubt it."
"He doesn't have to. Let me show you something." She went over to the PC and woke the screen. It was the native video player, and she set it to play. The frame filled with the video that they had shot from inside the wrecked trailer. Dalisai had brought the old camcorder that Josie remembered him using at the 10th birthday party of his daughter a month or two ago. It was a small palm-held unit, and they had been able to install it in the back of the burnt-out space so that it could record through the broken window without being too obvious from the outside. She scrubbed through the footage until she saw the Mercedes making its way down the slope to the clearing. She pressed the play button so that it ran at normal speed, presenting a nice, clear shot of the men who got out of the car and the weapons that they were carrying. Hicks and de Lacy were clear too, and, as she let the footage run, they watched as the other trailer was shot to pieces, as Hicks was ordered to the ground, and as de Lacy came forward to press the barrel of his pistol against Hicks's head. Josie saw de Lacy's reflection in the screen. He looked almost bored. She stopped the playback before Dalisai was shot. She had watched it once to make sure that it had been recorded, and she had no interest in watching it again. The picture froze, with de Lacy snarling down at Hicks, the gun at his head.
"You see," Josie said, "I don't need Milton. I don't need anyone. I have got all I need."
"Lawyer." She clenched her fists and fought the urge to bang them against the table.
"You're going back to Belibid, Mr. de Lacy, and you won't be getting out this time."
He smiled at her.
"Lawyer."
"Fine. You had your chance. We're done." She reached over and switched off the recorder.
"It's going to give me a lot of pleasure to put you away," she said.
She stood and went to the door. "Officer," he said. Josie stopped and turned back. De Lacy was staring at her.
"Do you really think your government is going to want to put me on trial? Be honest. Do you really think that's likely?"
"I think they'll relish it after what you've done."
"Well, then you're even more naive and out of your depth than I thought."
"Am I?"
"You know how long I've been in business? Years. Even when I was locked up, I still had people working for me. Nothing stops. The wheels keep turning. There are always deals to be done. People always want the goods I can find for them."
"Do you want me to remind you? You shot a police officer."
De Lacy ignored her. "I've worked for all kinds of people. I've worked for individuals, I've worked for companies and organisations, and I've worked for governments. Another question.
Shoot."
"How do you think I got out of Belibid?"
"I don't care."
"You should.
There is a deal to be done between two governments. It needs me before it can be completed.
Pressure was exerted, a phone call was made, and favours were offered. The deal still needs to be completed, and I'm still needed. All you have done is slowed things down by a day or two. How long do you think you'll be able to keep me here before you're told to let me go? That's not going to happen. We'll have to agree to disagree then, won't we? I suppose we will. He looked up at the clock on the wall. I'll give you my prediction. I'll be out of here by the end of the day. Good luck with that. I mean it. I'll be out of here before you finish your shift and go back to your mother and your child. How are they? It's Angelo, isn't it, your boy? Josie fought against the sudden pulse of rage. She had to bite down on her lip so hard that her tooth sliced into the flesh and she tasted blood. He was threatening her. He was threatening her son. She felt almost light-headed, a mixture of fury, fear and outrage that he had so little regard for her, that he was prepared to make threats despite the certain knowledge that the camera overhead was recording everything that he said and did. He thought his money could buy him impunity. She was afraid because she knew, deep down, that it was true. He was confident for good reason. He smiled at her and leaned back in his chair. Now, he said, I'd like to speak to my lawyer, please. Josie arranged for De Lacy to make a phone call, and, before the hour was out, she heard the clamour as two men and a woman were shown through the station and down into the basement where the holding cells were found. Josie went to the door to the stairs. Gloria joined her from the lobby. Lawyers? Josie asked. Wearing suits that cost more than I make in a month.
Officer Hernandez.
It was Station Commander Ocampo. He was responsible for the Sampaloc district and was an ornery, irascible veteran of 30 years. Josie had never spoken to him before, and he had only ever made fleeting visits to the station. She had been writing up the events of that afternoon. She stood, grimacing at the throb of pain from her leg. Yes, sir?
Were you responsible for arresting the man in the basement? Mr. De Lacy?
Yes, sir, I was.
You've got to let him go.
What?
You heard me. Let him out.
One of his men shot Manuel Dalisay. I have got it all on tape.
Let him out, officer. That's an order. And if I were you, I'd lose the tape.
No, she said. I won't. The commander took her by the elbow and led her into the corridor where they were less likely to be overheard.
I am serious, officer, he said sternly. You think I want to do this? I know what he did. But this comes from the top.
What does that mean?
It means the district director called me 20 minutes ago and told me that he's been leaned on by someone senior in the Justice Department. Very senior. Do you want me to spell it out for you?
He paused.
It's Josie, isn't it?
Yes, sir.
Think, Josie. This is being discussed way above us. Someone very important wants De Lacy to be out. We can't just put him back inside again, despite what he has done. If even half the things that I've heard about De Lacy are true, if he's connected to even a fraction of the people he claims, can you imagine for 1 second what would happen next? That the president won't get a phone call from Langley telling him that he has to make the problem go away, or Beijing, or Moscow.
He shrugged.
I am not blaming you. You didn't know where the case was going to go. You did a good job. But when it turns out this way, sometimes you just need to be pragmatic. This is one of those times.
No, she said. That's bullshit. He shot Manuel. He might die. And we know he's already directly responsible for at least 4 deaths.
What? The girl?
The owners of the bar and the hotel, too. At least, he threatened me and my son.
How is any of that going to count when you set it against the trouble that this could unleash?
He killed someone. That counts. He can't be above the law. I'm sorry, sir. I can't close my eyes.
It doesn't matter what you can or can't do, he said. You will process him and then let him out. That is a direct order.
If I let that go,
this is the big leagues, Josie. You don't count for shit. I have been here for 30 years. I don't count for shit. Decisions get made at pay grades way above us. And if we want to stay employed, we do exactly what we are told to do. That's the way this works. If you can't deal with that, you might as well just hand in your badge and go back to whatever it was you were doing before.
Josie took a breath. There was no point in arguing. Fine, she said. I understand, sir.
There's one other thing. I need you to take him to the marina. You are to see that he gets onto his yacht tonight. That's from me. He is not welcome in the Philippines any longer. You are to stay there and watch until he sets sail.
Yes, sir.
You have done good work. It'll stand in your favor when the time comes.
Thank you, sir, she said. He nodded down at her leg.
And go home, please. You shouldn't even be here.
He went back to the front of the station. Josie limped to the bathroom. She took out her phone and stared at the blank screen. She was shaking with anger. Let him go. How could she do that? De Lacy had to pay for the things that he had done. She thought of Manuel in the hospital. There was a good chance that he would die. She thought of his wife and child. She wasn't sure how she would be able to reconcile herself with that. She thought of the owner of the bar, dead. The husband and wife who had been shot in their office and then burned, dead. She thought of Mendoza's corruption. She thought of what Milton had been put through. De Lacy cloaked himself in death. It followed him everywhere. She thought of her mother and her son. She knew that they wouldn't be safe. No. She woke the phone and dialed. Chapter 87. Josie strapped on her weapon, grabbed her cane, and hobbled through the office to the stairs that led down to the basement. She paused for a moment at the top to gather her composure, and, her nerves settled, she started down. De Lacy was lying on the bench at the side of the cell. There were only 4 other detainees, and they had arranged themselves so that they each had space to stretch out. De Lacy looked reasonably comfortable. He was flat out on the bench, his legs straight, and his arms folded across his chest. She went to the clipboard where the paperwork was kept, took it down, and signed that she was taking custody of prisoner 1535 De Lacy Fitzroy. De Lacy saw her and swung his legs around so that they were on the floor. Ah, Officer Hernandez, nice to see you again. Get up, she said. I told you, he grinned. I'd be out before you finished your shift. You did, she said. Turn around, hands through the slot.
What for?
I'm going to cuff you.
No, you're going to release me. Why do I need to be cuffed?
My station commander has ordered me to transport you to the marina and put you on your yacht. He wants to make sure that you leave the country. I can get my own driver to collect me. This isn't necessary. Turn around and put your hands through the slot, please, sir. The sooner you do that, the sooner I can put you on your yacht and watch you fuck off over the horizon.
Where are my lawyers?
We told them that you're being released. She said, they'll meet you at the yacht. He looked as if he was going to protest before he shrugged his shoulders, turned and put his hands through the slot. "Fine," he said. "Get on with it." She took her cuffs and slapped them on. "Careful," de Lacy said with a grimace of pain. "You caught my skin."
"Sorry about that."
She called for the door to be unlocked, and when it was, she led him out. She could have taken de Lacy in the back of a squad car, but that didn't suit her. One of the station meat wagons was being hosed out after she guessed it had transported an addict into custody. The trucks grew hot, and the druggies often threw up in the back. The smell always seemed to linger, no matter how many times they were washed out. The thought of de Lacy baking in the back of the truck with the acrid tang of someone else's vomit in his nostrils gave her a small measure of pleasure. It was something. An officer that Josie knew was playing solitaire in the office. His name was Carlos. The rumour was that he was part of Mendoza's crew, and he was certainly someone with whom she would not normally have chosen to speak. But he was here, she needed a driver, and she thought he was well suited. "Give me a ride," she called out.
"I'm off duty," he said.
"Just to the marina, it'll take 20 minutes. Station commander wants it done."
"So take a squad car."
"He shot Dalisai," Josie explained. That got through to him.
"This is him."
She nodded. "I want him to get a ride in the truck." He tossed his cards down on the table and got up. Josie led de Lacy around to the back and waited for Carlos to grab his keys and unlock the door. "Get in," she said.
"It stinks," de Lacy complained.
"You want me to put you back in the cell again? Your choice, sir. You either get in and I get you on your way, or you go back and wait for someone else to take you. What's it going to be?" Carlos was a meathead, and Josie had plenty of reasons to doubt his morals, but she knew how he would react to attitude from a man who had shot a fellow officer, no matter how important he was reputed to be. He didn't give de Lacy a chance to answer. Instead, he grabbed him by the lapels, marched him up to the back of the truck, and then bundled him inside. De Lacy's shins clashed against the lip of the entrance, and he cursed in pain. Carlos slammed the interior door, and then the exterior one, before he could complain.
"Let's get him out of here," he said.
It was a journey of around 5 miles from Police Station 4 to the marina. There were two ways that Carlos could have chosen. The fastest would have been to take the Skyway to Avenida Epifanio de los Santos, continue west to the Globe Rotunda, and then go south on the J.W. Diocno Boulevard. The alternative was more direct, but along slower roads, east on Edison Avenue, then Buenida Avenue, and finally south on the boulevard. Carlos paused at the top of the station ramp and indicated that he was going to turn right toward the Skyway. "Go the other way," Josie said.
"Why? It's slower."
"Traffic. There was a crash earlier. It was backed up then, and it's the rush hour. It'll take forever."
"All right,"
he said, flicking the stalk to indicate left instead and pulling out onto Edison. The streets were named after famous inventors: Edison, Morse, Faraday, Bell, Marconi. Edison was a narrow street for most of its length, with cars parked on either side and a series of stalls set up on the pavements. They passed traders selling knock-off T-shirts, containers of fresh water, and trays of withered vegetables. Trash had been dumped at the side of the road, and the buildings were beaten up, many of them sporting tarpaulins where roofs and walls should have been.
"It's true, then?" Carlos asked.
"What's that?"
"He shot Dalisai."
She nodded.
"And we're letting him out."
"Tell me about it."
"What do you say we pull over? I could have a word with him about it in the back."
"I wouldn't mind that," she said. "But I don't think it's worth the aggravation. I'd rather just have him off my hands." Carlos grunted his dissatisfaction.
"I don't know what's happening right now. First Bruno, now Dalisai. If people think they can take shots at us and get away with it, Then?
A car raced out of Faraday Avenue and blindsided them, slamming hard into the wing on Josie's side of the truck. It had been travelling quickly, and the impact sent them skidding across the road and into the back of a car parked next to a repair shop. Carlos jerked forward, his forehead cracking against the wheel. Josie had braced herself, but the shock of the first and then second impacts had crashed her injured leg against the gear shift and sent a buzz of pain up and down her body. Carlos groaned and spat out a mouthful of blood. Josie looked outside. The car that had hit them was an old Toyota Camry. It had wedged itself beneath the truck. Their offside wheel was up on the crumpled hood of the car. The driver of the Toyota opened his door and stepped out as a second vehicle, a white delivery truck, skidded to a halt alongside them. The driver of the Camry was masked. He went around to the trunk of the car and took out a shotgun.
"What the fuck are they doing?"
Josie said. The man aimed his shotgun at them.
"Get out!"
Josie turned to Carlos.
"What do we do?"
she said. The second man banged on the window.
"Out!"
"Call for help," she said, pointing at the radio.
"Won't get to us in time," Carlos mumbled. "We're fucked."
"So what? We get out?"
"No choice. That window's not bulletproof. If he shoots, we're dead."
"They're bluffing."
"Are they? They just rammed us. I'm not taking the chance."
Carlos opened the door and, after a moment, Josie did the same. The two men had circled around so that one man was on one side of the truck and the other man was on the opposite side. They had both doors covered.
"Out!"
the man facing Josie barked.
"Hit the deck, face down. If you move, you're dead."
"Relax,"
Josie said loudly so that Carlos could hear her.
"We'll do whatever you want."
She lowered herself to the ground. The asphalt was hot, the grit abrasive against her cheek as she turned her head to watch. The second man was behind Carlos, leading him at gunpoint around to the back of the truck. Josie could see their feet and ankles beneath the chassis and heard the man tell Carlos that he needed to unlock the door.
"Stay down,"
the man above her ordered. The rear door was unlocked. She heard the heavy thwack of something solid striking flesh and then saw Carlos fall to the ground and lie still. His head was turned toward her and she saw blood leaking out of a fresh gash on his forehead. The doors, exterior and interior, were opened and then she heard a single barked command.
"Out!"
She saw the feet and lower legs of De Lacy as he stepped down and watched as he stumbled around to where she was lying. The other man was behind him, his shotgun jabbing De Lacy in the back as he was shepherded to the delivery truck.
"Open the door!"
Josie turned her head so that she could see. De Lacy said something and was rewarded with the butt of the shotgun jabbed against his ribs.
"Open it!"
He did as he was told, and before he could complain again, he was bundled inside. The door was slammed shut, and the man hurried around to the front of the vehicle.
"Stay there,"
the man behind Josie said, before running across to get into the truck. The engine whined, the tires squealed, and the truck left tracks of hot rubber as it raced away. Chapter 88. The back of the van was uncomfortable. De Lacy was sprawled on the floor, his hands still shackled behind him. He felt every bump as the van set off. The interior was divided into two compartments. The first was for the driver and co-driver. A tinted glass screen partitioned that area from the rear. It was dark in the back, with just a little dim light filtering through the tinted glass screen. De Lacy could see the shapes of the two men in the front compartment. He saw them remove the balaclavas that they had been wearing, but their features were hidden by the opacity of the glass. He managed to turn himself around so that his feet were facing the door. He started to kick out at them, putting all his weight behind each blow, but the doors were solid and didn't budge.
"Help!"
he called out as loudly as he could manage.
"Help!"
The van got going. It was difficult to judge the passage of time. They seem to have been travelling for an hour, but it might have been longer. De Lacy managed to arrange himself so that he could get up onto his knees and looked forward, trying to see the detail of the road ahead. But the glass in the dividing screen was too opaque, and he couldn't make out much of anything at all.
"Let me out!"
he shouted. Nothing.
"Do you have any idea who I am?"
The co-driver turned. He was little more than a silhouette.
"What do you want? Money? I'll pay you!"
The man glanced back at him, said something to the driver, and then turned to face the road again.
"Come on!"
De Lacy lost his balance and toppled onto his back. He kicked out, both feet thudding against the partition, but neither man turned around. They faced ahead, and the van kept moving along. De Lacy tried to guess. They must have been on the move for 2 hours now. The vague outlines of buildings that had been visible through the screen were no longer there. The light was fading as night drew in. They had left the city and must have been somewhere in the countryside that enclosed it. De Lacy was about to kick the partition again when the van slowed. He settled down, bracing his back against the wall and wedging his feet to keep him there as they bounced off the asphalt onto rough ground. The axle vibrated, and the back of the van bounced up and down, each small impact jarring him. They slowed.
"Hey!"
he shouted.
"Hey! Let me out!"
The bouncing subsided, and then the van drew to a halt. The driver and the co-driver opened their doors and stepped outside. The rear door opened. The sun was setting, and De Lacy was unable to make out the man who was standing outside. "Get out." De Lacy squinted into the fading light. Oh, fuck. It was Milton. He was wearing jeans and a T-shirt. His face was still marked by the beating that he had taken in Bilibid, dried cuts and bruises that were only now starting to heal. The second man joined Milton. De Lacy recognized him. It was the man who had tried to fool him as Logan. Milton had a pistol, the other man had a shotgun. "Get down, Fitz," Milton said. De Lacy backed away, but the compartment was small and there was only so much space he could retreat into. Milton clambered up, grabbed him by the lapels and hauled him toward the door. "Come on," De Lacy protested, unable to resist with his wrists still cuffed. "Come on, Milton, this isn't necessary." Milton didn't reply. Instead, he gave a final yank and propelled De Lacy out of the door. He managed to land on his feet, but he stumbled, his boot catching against a patch of scrub. He fell heavily, his face grinding into the small stones and gravel on the surface of the road. Milton jumped down from the back of the van. "Get him up." The other man reached down with one hand, grabbed the back of De Lacy's shirt and hauled him up.
"You want me to come?"
the second man said. "No, just me and him." De Lacy got his feet back under him and took the opportunity to look around. The road here was little more than an off-road track, scattered over with stones and littered with scrub. The van had left the track and driven for 300 yards. He could hear the sound of traffic passing on a busier road to the west. They were surrounded by stands of bamboo on both sides, with taller palm, pili and durian trees stretching out overhead. There were splashes of colour from sampaguita flowers, and bright orchids littered the way ahead. It would have been beautiful in other circumstances. "Where are we?" De Lacy asked. "Walk." "Take the cuffs off. Walk." Milton pushed De Lacy between the shoulder blades hard enough to make him stumble forward. He turned. The second man stayed by the truck. "Where are we going?" Milton pushed him again. "Walk." There was a pit of fear in his stomach. "Hernandez was in on this?" Milton said nothing. "You set me up. You're working together." He said nothing. "She wants to think carefully about that. Do you think it was a good idea to threaten her family, Fitz?" "She is a good officer, honest She wanted to do this by the book, but you couldn't help yourself, could you? And this is what happens. You think I was bluffing? No, I don't. And neither did she. But look where it's got you. It's just you and me now. You can't make threats anymore. Come on. This hasn't gone too far. Take me back. I don't think so. They'll lock me up again. You don't need to do this. You were locked up before, and you still murdered someone who was important to me. You like to remind everyone that you're a rich and powerful man. The money, the yacht, friends in high places. You would have been better to forget all that. He felt sick. What does that mean? He said, even though he knew exactly what it meant. Walk. They continued. Radiant waves rose from the sun-baked forest, and mirages shimmered at the edges of his vision. It was hot and humid. The fear, though, was worse. It leached the strength from his legs, hollowing them out, churned his stomach, and loosened his bowels. They descended a gentle slope to a burbling brook, and De Lacy couldn't stand it any longer. He ran. It was awkward, with his hands behind his back, but he ran. 3 paces, 4. He aimed for a thicket of bamboo on the other side of the water. Maybe if he could get there before Milton did, 10 paces, 15. He felt the blast of pain a moment before he heard the crack of the pistol. He lost his balance and fell, splashing down into the water. The gunshot echoed back from the foothills. His leg was on fire. He was lying face down, water in his eyes and mouth and nostrils. He felt the hot blood, each fresh heartbeat sending another pulse to flow out around his helpless fingers. He turned his head to look back. He hadn't managed to get very far. Milton was walking toward him. His right arm was extended and angled down. He had his pistol in his hand. De Lacy tried to scramble to his feet, but his leg wouldn't move and his arms were still shackled behind his back. Milton reached him. The setting sun was behind him, casting a long shadow and blackening him in silhouette. The shadow fell over De Lacy's body. Milton crouched down and flipped him over onto his back. De Lacy tried to speak, but his throat was dry and choked with water, and the words wouldn't come. He closed his eyes. Who put pressure on the Filipinos to get you out? He felt something press against his forehead. It was cold and hard. He knew what it was. Answer me, Fitz. The circus. Who do you think? Why do they want you out? They want me to front a deal with the Iranians. Missiles, artillery, ammunition. They don't care about the equipment. They want intelligence, and they know I can get it for them. And the Iranians trust me. And you said yes. With one condition. They got you for me. How'd that turn out, Fitz? De Lacy didn't answer. Who are you dealing with in MI6? Names? Latimer and Fox. I never met them. Who did? Bertie. He handled the negotiations. You'd have to speak to him. I will. Milton put his gun down and placed his hands around De Lacy's throat. He started to squeeze. De Lacy felt the coolness of the water as it ran around his head, and then the increased pressure around his throat as Milton leaned forward and pressed down with all his weight. He tried to breathe, but his breath wouldn't come. Goodbye, Fitz. His eyes bulged as he stared up into Milton's eyes, cold, impassive, emotionless, and then his face, the jungle, the sky, and everything else above him all faded into black. Chapter 89. Milton and Hicks drove back to the city after they had finished burying the body. They torched the stolen van, changed their clothes, and took a taxi the rest of the way to the airport. Ziggy was waiting for them in the landside Starbucks. Everything okay? He asked. It's done. What happened? It doesn't matter. What about the police? Well, I monitored the radio. Josie gave you 5 minutes and called it in. She said she didn't get a good look at the van. They put out a bulletin, but there was no way they would have been able to find you in time. The other thing?
Ziggy sipped his coffee and nodded. They've identified the bodies at Tondo. Bruno Mendoza was easy. The car was registered to him, and they matched his teeth to his dental records. The second body has been reported as John Smith, recently escaped from Bilibid. They found the gun, pulled the prints from it, and when they searched against them, they had a match with the prints you gave them when you were arrested. They can't confirm it for sure, but it's strong circumstantial evidence. As far as they're concerned, John Smith is dead. They're looking for someone who shot him and Mendoza.
Good, he said. You think it'll stand up?
I doubt they've got anything that would help them to identify the body as Logan. Even if they can take his fingerprints, I'd be surprised if he's on record anywhere. And I've got an idea to make it even tighter.
Hicks scrubbed his eyes. None of them had had much sleep.
Milton reached into his pocket and took out Hicks's wedding ring.
Here, he said. Better not forget this.
Hicks took the ring and screwed it onto his finger.
Thanks.
Ziggy looked up at the departures board. We'd better check in, he said. The flight goes in an hour.
Thank you, Milton said, both of you. I'd still be locked up if it wasn't for what you did.
You'd be dead, Hicks corrected.
Milton nodded, more likely, he agreed. But I mean it. I'm grateful, really. Forget it.
Milton put out his hand and shook with Ziggy and then Hicks.
What are you going to do?
Hicks said. Some people I need to see, he said.
And then?
I don't know yet.
Milton arranged to meet Josie in a cafe near the Napindan Castle Hotel where she was staying. He arrived first. He put the leather satchel that he had taken from Mendoza's villa on the floor beneath a vacant table and then went to get his food. The place offered a breakfast buffet, and he doled out a generous portion of tokilog. He hadn't eaten since the sandwiches he and Ziggy had shared the previous night, and the trays of sweetened pork, egg and fried rice were impossible to resist. He finished his plate quickly, and as he took it up to the counter for another portion, he saw Josie looking for him in the doorway. He waved her over. She had a bag in her left hand and her walking stick in her right. She hobbled over, rested the bag on the floor next to the table and sat down.
Well?
It's finished, he said.
Where?
We buried him. He won't be found. She turned away from him, biting her lip. He felt the need to justify himself. There wasn't any other choice. When she turned back to him, her eyes were cold.
I am not sorry, she said. He got what he deserved.
Milton knew. She had striven so long to do the right thing, and now his news, and the sure knowledge that she had facilitated De Lacy's murder, was her repudiation of it. She was angry with herself, not with him. The curtain had been pulled back, and now she saw how the world worked.
It's my own fault, she said, as if she could read his mind. De Lacy called me naive. Turns out he was right.
She reached down and placed her hand on her injured leg.
What about you? Milton asked. What happened afterwards?
After you took him. They took us to the station. We were questioned. But Carlos backed me up. The crash, the two of you taking him and driving away, our stories tallied. They said they believed it. What else were they going to say?
And then?
They had the whole district out searching for you. I told them I didn't get a good look at the truck, but there were witnesses on the street who did.
Where is it now?
We torched it.
Milton noticed that she was looking to the door. He turned and looked. An older woman who bore a striking resemblance to Josie was standing there. She was holding the hand of a young boy.
Mama!
Josie called out, waving at her. The old woman turned. The boy turned too, and on seeing Josie, he tugged his hand free and ran full pelt toward the table. Josie hugged him, grimacing as he bumped up against her leg and then delicately disentangled him.
The old woman reached the table and looked down at Josie's stretched-out leg and the walking stick. She put her hand to her face. Josie struggled to her feet and embraced her, then spoke earnestly to her again. Milton could tell that she was trying to reassure her. The boy saw the stick, and Josie spoke calmly to him too. They finished their conversation. "They haven't seen me since I was shot," she explained. "I haven't been home, and I thought it best not to tell them on the phone. They'd only worry."
"Do they know who I am?"
"No." She gestured to where Milton was sitting and spoke in Filipino again. Milton caught his name at the end of the sentence. He turned to Josie's mother. "Hello," he said. The woman regarded him with unmasked suspicion. Josie spoke to her again. "Mama is very protective of me. She doesn't mean to be rude."
"It's fine," Milton said. "I'd be suspicious too."
He turned to the boy. "And this is your son?" The boy looked up at him shyly. The boy looked at his mother and then at Milton. He showed the same suspicion as his grandmother.
"Angelo,"
Josie chided, "say hello."
"Hello."
Milton had never been good with children. "Hello," he said. "How are you?" The boy shrugged.
"He's shy,"
Josie apologized.
"But he speaks very good English."
"Do you?" Milton asked.
"Mama says so,"
Angelo said quietly.
"Are you her friend?"
"I am," Milton said.
"She's been shot."
He said it with wide eyes, as if the information, when shared with his friends at school, would mean an elevation in his status. Milton smiled at him. "Mama," Josie said, before continuing in Filipino. The older woman nodded and took the boy's hand and led him away from the table.
"I asked her to give us a moment,"
Josie explained. Milton stood. "It's okay, I'll go. You should be with them. I don't want to intrude." She ignored that.
"You asked what I did last night. I didn't get to finish. I went to see Dalisai in the hospital.
He's going to make it. Another centimetre either side and he'd be dead now, just like I could have been dead. We were both lucky. I spoke to him, and he helped me make up my mind. So I went back to my desk, wrote up my resignation letter and mailed it. I'm done." Milton listened to her, and when she was finished, he reached out and laid his hand over hers.
"I don't blame you. I would have done the same thing."
She took her hand away.
"Principles are great, but now I have to put food on the table."
"Got any ideas?" "Maybe," he said.
"I'm listening."
"There's one more thing you can do for me first." She nodded that he should go on. "They've identified Logan's body," he said. "They think it's me."
"And you want them to think that?"
"Yes. I left my prints on the gun I left there. They have matched it with the prints you took when you arrested me."
"So you want me to say that I saw you being shot? An unidentified man shot you and Mendoza, and then the same guy shot me in the leg. Could you do that?"
"Sure."
"What's one more lie going to mean? I'm already up to my neck in them."
"When I was in the car with Mendoza on the way to Tondo, I made him take the expressway. Do the cameras on the toll booths work?"
"Usually," she said.
"If you check the video, you'll be able to find his car. I made sure I was looking at the camera. We used the second lane from the right. You'll be able to match it with my photos and prove I was in his car. I doubt you'll need anything else."
She nodded.
"Okay,"
she said. "I'll do it. Thank you."
Milton took the leather satchel and gave it to her. "You asked if I could help." "I can. Here." She unzipped the satchel, opened the mouth, and looked inside. Milton could see the thick wedges of banknotes.
"What is this?"
"I thought you... Where did you get it?"
"From Mendoza," I found it under the floor in his villa. She zipped the bag up again and put it on the table. No, you said it yourself. You're going to need money. Not if it's dirty. It's just money. It doesn't matter where it came from.
Of course it does.
Keep it, donate it, do whatever you want with it. It's up to you. She stared at the bag for a moment. Milton could see that she was considering it. He could guess at her competing thoughts. She was weighing the integrity that was so obviously important to her against the exigencies of providing for her son without a regular wage.
Thank you,
she said at last. It's the least I could do. He offered her his hand and she took it.
Be careful, John.
You too. He was about to leave when she put her hand to her forehead.
Wait, she said. I almost forgot. I brought you something too.
She reached down awkwardly and collected the bag from the floor. She put it on the table and pushed it over to Milton. He opened it and reached inside. It contained the things that she had taken from him when he had been arrested. He took out his copy of the big book and flipped through the pages. I went and got it from evidence, she said. I thought you'd want it.
I do. Thank you.
He saw the flashes of yellow where he had highlighted the passages that meant the most to him. They reminded him that he needed to get to a meeting.
Where are you going to go? She asked.
I haven't decided yet. I need some time to think.
I'll see you around then, Milton.
Good luck. The old woman and the boy were waiting in the road outside the cafe. Milton paused and knelt down before the boy.
Your mother is very brave, he said. Look after her.
Milton didn't know whether Angelo would understand him, but the boy stood a bit straighter and gave a solemn little nod.
I will,
he said. Milton smiled at him and shook his little hand. He stood, said goodbye to Josie's mother, and made his way back to his car. Chapter 90. Milton drove for 4 hours. The city of Lucena was 120 miles southeast of Manila, and he followed the main north-south route to Calamba and then turned to the east. He passed the wide inland waterway of Laguna de Bay and then the holy mountain of Mount Banahaw. He stopped to refuel and looked out at the volcano. Its huge bulk wreathed with clouds and dominating the landscape for miles around. His thoughts ran away with him again. He had spent the drive thinking about Josie and Angelo, and that, in turn, had prompted him to think about Jessica and her son. The suggestion that he might have been a father had stirred up a maelstrom of feelings that he hadn't even started to unpack. In truth, he didn't know where to start. That vague possibility, raised by a woman that he hadn't seen for 10 years, had caused him to leave his cloistered life and fly halfway around the world. It had diffused his natural caution and had very nearly led to his death. His impulsive reaction was out of character, and it raised questions and possibilities that he had never considered before. He had never thought himself capable of paternal feelings. Children made him feel awkward. He didn't know what to say to them. He didn't know how to deal with them. More than all of that, he didn't think he deserved the happiness that children might bring. He had shunned conventional relationships for the same reason. He had always believed he had too much to atone for to allow himself the luxury of happiness. What had changed? He didn't know. He didn't really know why he was driving south either, only that it was something that he felt he had to do. Milton went inside the gas station to pay and bought a bundle of 12 cigarillos, unfiltered cigarettes that were wrapped in colourful printed paper. He went outside and lit up. The stick was longer than the brands that he bought at home, and the tobacco had a sweet kick during the drag. They were probably unhealthy, but Milton didn't care. He needed a vice, and this was better than the alternative. They were more intense, too, than the cigarettes that he usually smoked. And that was something he could use to take his mind off his confusion and what he was intending to do. He got back into the car, wound down the windows, and set off to the east once more. The address that Ziggy had found was on Evangelista Street. It ran through a low-rent commercial district, and as Milton cruised along it, he passed a pharmacy, a car wash, and a women's fashion shop. The sat-nav bleeped that he had reached his destination. He pulled over into a space at the side of the road, checked the address once again, and got out. He walked back along the street until he got to Papai, a fast-food bakery that was advertised by a cartoon character designed to look like Popeye in a chef's hat. There was a faded hoarding above the shop, and suspended from two chains, attached to a rickety L-shaped pole, was a sign that creaked as it oscillated back and forth in the light breeze that blew in off the sea. The cafe was housed on the ground floor of a two-story building. The paint was peeling away, the windows were barred, and washing had been hung out to dry on the first-floor balcony. Milton approached. Access to the interior of the bakery was blocked by a metal cage, with transactions carried out through an open slot. Milton idled there, pretending to look at the simple menu that had been painted onto a wooden board and propped against the wall. The cafe specialised in pandesal, sweetened dough that was rolled into long loaves that were then rolled in fine breadcrumbs. The bakery also sold hot coffee, and Milton watched through the bars as an old woman ripped off a hunk of a loaf, dipped it in her mug, and then ate it. There was a woman being served ahead of him, and he watched as she chatted with the man serving her. She put a dozen of the loaves into a white plastic carrier bag, gave the man a handful of pesos, and went on her way. Milton stepped forward. "Hello," he said. "Do you speak English?" The man shrugged, his top lip curling a little.
"What do you want?"
"I was looking for Jessica."
"Who are you?"
"A friend."
"She dead,"
the man said.
"What?" "Last week."
Milton feigned shock.
"How?" "Manila,"
the man said, as if the suggestion that someone should go to the capital was the height of foolishness.
"Someone kill her."
"That's awful. I'm sorry." The man shrugged.
"Not so unusual there. Should have stayed here."
"Are you family?" He shook his head.
"I just work here."
He pointed behind Milton at a woman who was waiting to be served.
"What do you want?"
"Did Jessica have any family?"
"Her father. He owns the bakery."
"And children?" The man frowned his annoyance at the continued questions.
"She got a boy. You want any bread, mister?"
"Yes," Milton said. There was a tray of prepared snacks just inside the bars. Milton pointed to one.
"What's that?" "Peanut butter and jelly sandwich, you want?"
"Please." The man picked up the sandwich with his fingers and folded it inside a piece of grease paper. He handed the parcel through the bars.
"7 pesos.
The menu said that the sandwiches should have cost 3 pesos. The man was taking advantage of what he must have concluded was a naive foreigner, but Milton didn't mind. He gave him a 10-peso coin and held up his hand to say that he didn't expect the change. Milton stepped aside. The woman behind him came forward, regarding him with a distasteful expression, and then saying something in Filipino that drew a derisive chuckle from the server. Milton took his sandwich and crossed the road. He got back into the car and settled in to wait. 2 hours had passed when Milton saw a boy on a bicycle pull up outside the bakery. He put the half-finished sandwich on the passenger seat and looked out at him. He was young, perhaps 10 years old, and slender. He was wearing a golden black New Orleans Saints cap, beneath which Milton could see an unruly mop of black hair. Milton put his hand on the handle of the door and then paused. He realised he still had no idea what he had come here to do. The boy took a key from his pocket and unlocked a door to the side of the metal cage. He opened it and wheeled his bicycle inside. Milton stayed where he was. The boy emerged again, closed and locked the door, and crossed the road to the car wash on the other side. Milton clenched his fists in frustration. He grabbed the plastic bag from the passenger seat, opened the door and got out. "Hello?" The boy looked at him anxiously.
"Who are you?"
he replied in excellent English. "My name is John. I was a friend of your mother. What's your name?"
"Danilo."
The boy had dark skin and dark hair, and his eyes were dark and soulful, just like his mother's had been. He wasn't the same as the boy whose pictures Milton had seen. That boy had borne a resemblance to him, but Danilo could never have been mistaken for his kin. There was no similarity at all. Milton was floundering. "I just wanted to say that I'm sorry about what happened to her." The boy looked at him in confusion. Milton heard an angry shout from the bakery. He turned to see that the cage door had been opened and a man was coming out. It wasn't the server to whom he had spoken before, but an older man with white streaks in his hair and a grizzled grey beard. He called out in Filipino. Milton waited for him to make his way across. "I'm a friend of Jessica," he said.
"I've never seen you before."
"It was a long time ago." The old man took the boy by the elbow and impelled him back to the building.
"She's dead,"
he said gruffly, once the boy was inside and out of earshot. "I know," he said. "Are you her father?"
"That's right."
"I'm sorry. I have something for you. For the boy, really." He handed the man the plastic bag. He opened it and looked inside.
"What is this?"
The man reached in and took out one of the bundles of banknotes. Milton had split Mendoza's money, half for Josie and half for Jessica's son.
"What is this?"
"It's yours," Milton insisted.
"Where you get it?"
"I hope it helps." Milton didn't wait for the man's response. He got back into the car and looked out of the windshield as the man stared dumbly from the bundle of notes to the car and then back again. He started the engine and drove off, leaving the bakery behind him. He tried to work out how he was feeling. Was it relief? Disappointment? He sat quietly and realised that he knew what it was. It was that same sense of loneliness that he had come to consider as his closest friend. It had been his companion for all the months he had been travelling, all the thousands of miles that he had covered. It had been there as he had tried to make a modest life for himself in London. It was always there, an ache in his gut that he could always find whenever he closed his eyes and searched for it. He had kept a tiny fraction of the money for himself. It was in the glove box. There was enough for a ticket on the long-distance ferry from Manila to Ho Chi Minh City, and then enough to keep him going for a month or two after that. He hadn't been to Southeast Asia for years. He thought he might start in Vietnam, then head into Thailand, Myanmar, and India. He liked the idea of Nepal. He hadn't seen Everest before. Maybe he'd go to base camp. That would be something to aim for. It would be just him and the road. That was fine. He enjoyed his own company. He welcomed solitude. He decided to cherish it for a little while. He turned north, back to the city, and to whatever might come next. This has been an Audible Studios production of Blackout, written by Mark Dawson, performed by David Thorpe.